Siraj Mal's relations with the Sikhs were guided mainly by two considerations. Firstly, the Jat ruler of Bharatpur aimed at building up a strong confederacy between the Chambal and Ravi so as to interpose a hindrance between the Dharanis and Rohilas and thus prevent them from combining against the Jats of Bharatpur. Secondly, he endeavored to expel Najib-ud-Daulah from Delhi and establish his control over the imperial court with the help of the Sikhs. Siraj Mal realized the danger of the Rohilla ascendancy at Delhi and its inevitable results on the security of his borders. Mandajit Kaur, Politics of the Sikhs with the Jats of Bharatpur in the Latter Half of the 18th Century, Proceedings of the Indian History Congress, Volume 34, 1973. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back to Season 10 of the Islamic History Podcast. This season, we are continuing our discussion on the Mughal Empire. This is Episode 10-7, The Mercenary. Trouble with the Jats. We've mentioned the Jats in earlier episode, and we also discussed them in the previous season. The Jats are an agricultural community from northern India and Pakistan. They are known for their martial skills and farming expertise. The Jats are predominantly settled in the modern Indian states of Punjab, Haryana, Rajasthan, and Uttar Pradesh. They are also culturally diverse, with some of them practicing Hinduism, some practicing Sikhism, and some of them practicing Islam. In June 1763, the Jat army, led by their king Siraj Mal, occupied Agra and the land south of the Yamuna River. This left the Mughals with only Delhi and its surroundings. From Agra, the Jats expanded into Alwar, imprisoned the governor, and then occupied Farrukhabad. Farrukhabad is about 155 miles east of Delhi. Najib-ud-Daulah, the Mughal Grand Vizier, led an assault on the Jats in late December 1763. Siraj Mal was killed in this fighting, and his son, Jawahar, became the Maharaja of the Jat Kingdom of Bharatpur. Jawahar allied with the Marathas and the Sikhs against Najib-ud-Daulah and the Mughals. In January 1764, 12,000 Sikhs and 25,000 Marathas joined with the Jats in an assault on Delhi. But the Mughals were well entrenched in Delhi and repelled Jawahar's forces. The two sides finally agreed on a peace deal in February 1764. However, Jawahar suspected that the Marathas had made their own deal with Najib-ud-Daulah. Furthermore, Ahmed Shah Durrani, that is the Afghan ruler, was on the march again. As mentioned in the previous episode, the Sikhs had revolted against the Afghans in 1763. This prompted Ahmed Shah Durrani to move on Punjab again. With this threat underway, the Sikhs lost interest in Delhi and immediately returned to Punjab. Meanwhile, Jawahar and his Jats returned to Mathura to deal with a rebellion led by his half-brother. The Battle of Buxar. The Mughal Emperor, Shah Alam II, was supposedly a guest of Shuja-ud-Daulah, the Nawab of Awadh. But in reality, the Emperor was little more than a prisoner. Meanwhile, the British were consolidating their already strong presence in Bengal. They had nearly free rein since the Nawab of Bengal, Mir Qasim, was essentially their puppet. Mir Qasim owed his position as the Nawab to the British, which allowed them to rule Bengal by proxy. Naturally, Mir Qasim did not like the situation. He abolished toll taxes in Bengal for both Indians and British in order to level the playing field between British and Indian merchants. Well, naturally, the British didn't like this competition, and so they decided that Mir Qasim had to go. They forced him off the throne and replaced him with his uncle and predecessor, Mir Jafar. Mir Qasim fled to Awadh in February 1764 with his army and as much treasure as he could carry. He used this wealth to create an alliance with Shuja-ud-Daulah and his puppet emperor, Shah Alam II. Together, the three allies marched on Bihar and laid siege to Patna in October 1764. They were also joined by the Iranian mercenary Mirza Najaf. The British army in this confrontation had a little over 7,000 soldiers, and nearly three-quarters of the British forces were made up of Indian sepoys. The Mughal alliance, however, had around 40,000 soldiers. Nonetheless, the British gained the upper hand early on in the battle. Shuja-ud-Dawla, that is the Nawab of Awadh, fled across the river, and then in a very cowardly move, he destroyed the boat bridge crossing the river, thereby cutting off a good portion of his army, including the emperor and Mirza Najaf, that is the Iranian mercenary. Now, trapped on the wrong side of the river, Mirza Najaf and the emperor had to negotiate a surrender to the British. This, the Battle of Buxar, was a turning point in Indian history. This battle essentially set the table for India to become a British colony. Shuja-ud-Dawla reorganized his forces and tried to fight the British again, this time at the Battle of Kora in May 1764. But he was decisively defeated. With this defeat, Robert Clive, who was now Lord Clive, negotiated the Treaty of Allahabad in August 1764. Robert Clive was the British governor of the presidency of Fort William. Listen to this quote regarding Robert Clive's return to India. Since he had arrived back in India, Clive had quickly succeeded in achieving two of his greatest ambitions, a seat in Parliament and a peerage, albeit an Irish one, which was then considered much less grand than one in England, which gave the holder a place in the Westminster House of Lords. He had bought land and collected estates, squabbled with the directors of the company, and quickly got bored. "We are not so happy in England as you imagine," he wrote to Carnac in May 1762. "Many of us envy our way of life in India." So when he was offered the governorship of Bengal with unprecedented powers to reform the government and settle company control over great swathes of Asia, he did not hesitate. At sundown on 4 June 1764, he sailed out of Portsmouth on the Kent for his third posting in India. He left his wife and children at the quayside and was accompanied instead by a French chef, a band of four musicians, and 12 dozen chests of champagne. The Anarchy by William Dalrymple. So this new position for Robert Clive basically meant that he was in charge of British affairs in Bengal, or EIC affairs in Bengal, which ultimately meant British affairs just as well. The Treaty of Allahabad separated Allahabad from Awadh and gave it to the Mughal Emperor. The British also agreed to pay the emperor an annual 2.8 million rupee stipend. Now this stipend, even though it might sound like a lot, was nothing. Nothing compared to the wealth the British would wind up extracting from Bengal. With this treaty, the emperor gave the EIC, the East India Company, permission to collect the taxes for Bengal, Bihar, and Orissa. So not only was the Mughal emperor now dependent on the British, the EIC, the East India Company, a corporation, a company, now ruled over 30 million people. When you collect the taxes, you control the people who are paying those taxes. Shuja-ud-Dawla lost half of Awadh and had to pay a 5 million rupee indemnity. As a consolation, he was offered the position of Grand Vizier for the Mughal Empire, but he never officially took the office. The Emperor returns to Delhi. The ruler of Afghanistan, Ahmed Shah Durrani, died in 1763 in Kandahar. He is considered the father of modern Afghanistan and is often called Ahmed Shah Baba by Afghans. With Ahmed Shah Durrani dead, the Marathas were now hoping to regain what they lost at the Battle of Panipat in 1761. Hence, in February 1771, another Maratha Confederate army crossed into northern India and attacked Delhi. After a brief skirmish, the Marathas captured the city yet again. Meanwhile, Emperor Shah Alam II was growing restless in Allahabad, where he was kept under British control. He had gone from being a prisoner of Shuja-ud-Dawla to now being a prisoner of the British. And the British made sure he knew this, insulting him at every opportunity they got. Frustrated by these British insults, the emperor sent an envoy to negotiate with the Marathas in Delhi. Emperor Shah Alam II wanted to return to Delhi and the throne of his ancestors. Well, the Marathas agreed to allow the emperor to return to Delhi, but of course, he had to pay them 4 million rupees and give them various holdings throughout North India in return. The British also agreed to let him return to Delhi, though they did warn him not to trust the Marathas. Somewhat interesting coming from the British. In January 1772, the Mughal emperor finally returned to Delhi after nearly 13 years. But the reality was that the emperor was still a puppet and still a prisoner. All he did was just change masters from the British in Allahabad to the Marathas in Delhi. Military successes in the 1770s. On his way to Delhi, the emperor battled the Bangash tribes in Rohilkhand and forced them to submit. This took place in what is now northern Uttar Pradesh, roughly 130 miles east of Delhi. Najib-ud-Dawla, the Mughal Grand Vizier, died in 1770, and he was succeeded by his son, Zabita Khan. When Shah Alam II arrived in Delhi, he called on Zabita Khan to pay homage. He also wanted Zabita Khan to take his late father's role as the Mir Bakshi, or the army paymaster. However, for some strange reasons, Zabita Khan refused and instead fled and took refuge in Shukartel, which was the Rohilla stronghold. Well, the emperor sent Mirza Najaf, that's the Iranian mercenary we discussed earlier, the emperor sent Mirza Najaf along with his Maratha armies to bring Zabita Khan back. Mirza Khan and the Marathas easily defeated Zabita Khan, who then fled to Awadh and took refuge with Shuja-ud-Dawla, that is, the Nawab of Awadh. Ironically, Shuja-ud-Dawla had convinced the Marathas to support Zabita Khan. It turns out the emperor still owed the Marathas 3 million rupees for letting him back into Delhi. So the Mughal army, led by Mirza Khan, fought against the combined forces of Shuja-ud-Dawla and Zabita Khan in several skirmishes just outside of Delhi. However, with no clear winner, they decided to negotiate a peace settlement. Zabita Khan was appointed as Mir Bakshi, the army paymaster, the same position that he had rejected and literally ran away from, and the Marathas were given Allahabad and Kora, even though Shuja-ud-Dawla was supposedly governing these lands under British protection. These overlapping agreements get very confusing and really complicated. Nonetheless, this agreement gave imperial legitimacy to the Maratha claims, and the Marathas used this influence to pressure the emperor to dismiss the Iranian mercenary Mirza Najaf. Well, the emperor complied, and the Marathas promptly turned around and hired Mirza Najaf to work for them instead. With the agreement in place, the Marathas moved in to occupy Allahabad. However, the British forces blocked their way, and battle took place between the British and the Marathas in March 1773. The British defeated the Marathas, thereby ending Maratha expansion into the north for the time being. The Marathas eventually retreated to the Deccan, and then they dismissed Mirza Najaf, who then returned to serve under the Mughals. The Mercenary and the Jats. Now that he was working for the Mughals, Mirza Najaf wanted to punish the Jats. He also hoped to recover Mughal wealth that the Jats had looted over the years. With this in mind, he raised an army of 20,000 men and hired several skilled officers to lead this army. Mirza Najaf attacked the Jat fortress of Maidangari, and the fort fell after several hours of fierce fighting. Well, the Jats retaliated by raiding Mughal territory and killing Mughal officials. The two sides again clashed on 15 September 1773 at Dunkar. This was about 20 miles east of Delhi. The Jats were defeated and retreated across the Yamuna River, thereby vacating all Mughal lands in the Doab. As mentioned in the previous episode, the Doab was the region between the Yamuna and Ganges rivers. Later that month, Mirza Najaf began advancing swiftly through Jat territory. The Mughals and Jats clashed once again at Barsana, roughly 60 miles southeast of Delhi. And once again, Mirza Najaf was victorious. Listen to this quote regarding the battle at Barsana. In June 1773, the Jat Raja, Nawal Singh of Bharatpur, opened negotiations with the Sikhs to elicit their support against Mirza Najaf Khan. He planned an expedition against the imperial territories. He wished the Sikhs to provide reinforcement and move in concert with the Jat forces in Haryana and Doab. The Sikhs were not ready for hasty action, but Nawal Singh was not prepared for postponement. The impatient Jat Raja sought a war with a stronger enemy without Sikh support, which rendered him into a position of absolute political isolation. The result was obvious. Mirza Najaf Khan defeated Nawal Singh in a battle on 30th October 1773 and occupied Barsana. The Mughal generals had already scattered the Jat forces in the Doab. Mandajit Kaur, Politics of the Sikhs with the Jats of Bharatpur in the Latter Half of the 18th Century, Proceedings of the Indian History Congress, Volume 34, 1973. After this victory at Barsana, Mirza Najaf's armies turned towards Agra, which the Jats had previously plundered and now controlled. Additionally, Shuja-ud-Dawla, the Nawab of Awadh, had sent an army equipped with heavy artillery to assist Mirza Najaf against the Jats. Agra fell to the Mughals on 8 February 1774. The Mughals moved on to Balabgarh and Farukabad, recapturing both cities from the Jats in the spring of 1774. In 1775, the Mughals launched a new campaign against the Jats. The Mughals made significant advances, capturing Sadabad, Jawar, and Ramgarh in the Doab region, and Kama in Mawat. Now that they were running out of territory, the Jats retreated to Deeg, about 75 miles south of Delhi, where they were supported by the Maharaja of Jaipur. Around this time, Ranjit Singh, one of Suraj Mal's sons, became the new Jats Maharaja. From November 1775 to April 1776, the Mughals besieged Deeg, which was the last Jat holdout. Finally, in late April 1776, Ranjit Singh fled and the Mughals occupied Deeg. The following year, in 1777, Ranjit Singh attempted to reclaim some of the lands he'd lost, but once again, Mirza Najaf led the Mughal forces, and they were victorious. He captured the Jat fortress at Sonk, which was roughly 80 miles south of Delhi. The Mughals executed the Jat soldiers garrisoned at the fort and sold their women and children into slavery. Ranjit Singh fled to Bharatpur, which was about 20 miles east of Sonk, but within 2 months, Bharatpur fell to the Mughals as well. This time, however, Mirza Najaf showed mercy and decided not to destroy the Jat kingdom all the way. Instead, he restored Bharatpur to Ranjit Singh, and now the Jats were allies of the Mughals. That will be it for today's episode. In the next episode, inshallah, we will discuss the actions of two Rohilas and how they helped to bring about the demise of the Mughal Empire. You've been listening to the Islamic History Podcast, and we hope you've enjoyed the show. You can support the Islamic History Podcast and get exclusive content by subscribing to our premium channel, Islamic History Exclusive. If you're an Apple or Spotify user, open the app and search for Islamic History Exclusive. If you're listening on Podbean, become a patron in the app and you'll get access to our premium content. You can also join by visiting patreon.com/Islamic History. I'd also like to thank Brother Zulfikar Sarosh for his research on the Mughal Empire and his continued support of the show. And thanks to all of our premium subscribers. Be sure to join the Islamic History Podcast Telegram group where you can download a copy of today's transcript. Finally, subscribe to the Islamic History Podcast YouTube channel for our video documentaries. Stay tuned for a short clip from the latest season of the Umayyad Caliphate. Until next time, my name is Muttaki Ismail for the Islamic History Podcast. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the Umayyad Caliphate Season 3, presented by Islamic History Exclusive. This season, we are discussing the years 96 to 105 AH. This is episode 3-7, Muhammad ibn Ali. We're going to start our story by talking about the events of 101 AH. In the previous episode, we mentioned how Yazid ibn Muhallab was imprisoned by the then caliph Umar ibn Abdulaziz. However, when he heard, that is when Yazid ibn Muhallab heard that the caliph was sick, he began planning his escape. Yazid ibn Muhallab knew that Yazid ibn Abdul Malik was going to succeed Umar ibn Abdulaziz as the Umayyad caliph. Yazid ibn Abdul Malik had a grudge against Yazid ibn Muhallab. Now here's why Yazid ibn Abdul Malik of Banu Umayyah hated Yazid ibn Muhallab. Back in 96 AH, Sulayman ibn Abdul Malik, that is Caliph Sulayman ibn Abdul Malik, he appointed Yazid ibn Muhallab to be governor of Iraq. We discussed this in the previous episode, back when a man named Saleh ibn Abdurrahman was selected to be Iraq's treasurer. We also discussed how Saleh ibn Abdurrahman was the one who prevented Yazid ibn Muhallab from embezzling funds. In episode 2 of this season, we discussed how now that he was governor of Iraq, Yazid ibn Muhallab retaliated against Hajjaj ibn Yusuf by torturing and killing some of the members of Hajjaj's family. Well, in actuality, Yazid ibn Muhallab ordered his treasurer, Saleh ibn Abdurrahman, to carry this punishment out. This was all done in retaliation for Hajjaj ibn Yusuf killing Saleh ibn Abdurrahman's brother back when Hajjaj was the governor of Iraq. Now, one of those people who were tortured was Hajjaj ibn Yusuf's niece, Ummul Hajjaj. Ummul Hajjaj was Yazid ibn Abdul Malik's wife, that is Yazid ibn Abdul Malik from Banu Umayyah. She was his wife and the mother of their son, Walid ibn Yazid. Yazid ibn Muhallab knew that Yazid ibn Abdul Malik wanted to get revenge for torturing his wife. In fact, it was known that Yazid ibn Abdul Malik had made a vow to cut off one of Yazid ibn Muhallab's limbs if he ever got the chance. So therefore, Yazid ibn Muhallab knew he had to get out of prison as quickly as possible. And this desire to escape became more urgent as Umar ibn Abdulaziz's condition grew worse. As it became evident that Umar ibn Abdulaziz might die, Yazid ibn Muhallab put his plan to escape prison into action. He had his mawali prepare camels for him and bring them near the prison. Then he snuck out of prison. I don't know how he was able to sneak out of prison so easily, but he snuck out of prison and met up with his wali near a previously agreed upon place. The mawali were accompanied by Yazid ibn Muhallab's wife, and from there he was able to make his escape. Now let's listen to this brief exchange between Yazid ibn Muhallab and Umar ibn Abdulaziz. He traveled for a while, and when he had gone a certain distance, he wrote to Omar ibn Abdulaziz as follows. By God, if I knew that you were going to live, I would not have left my place of confinement, but I do not trust Yazid ibn Abdul Malik. Omar exclaimed, O God, if Yazid ibn Muhallab wishes evil on this community, ward off his evil deed, and turn this hostile action back on his own neck. Now let's take some time to discuss the death of Omar ibn Abdulaziz. Omar ibn Abdulaziz died in the year 102 AH in the month of Rajab, which roughly corresponds to 720 CE. Once again, we'll turn to Tariqh al-Tabari and read about Omar ibn Abdulaziz's death. Fatima, the wife of Omar ibn Abdulaziz, said, He became extremely uncomfortable one night, and we stayed up with him. The next morning, I instructed one of his servants, by the name of Marthid, saying, Marthid, stay with Amir al-Mu'mineen so that if he needs anything, we will be close at hand. Then we left, and our heads were throbbing because we had stayed up so late. At midday, I awoke and went to him, but I found Marthid sleeping outside of his room. I woke him up, saying, Marthid, who told you to leave? He said, The Caliph did. He said, Marthid, leave me, for by God, I see something that is neither human nor jinn. As I left, I heard him reciting this verse. That is the last abode. We appointed for those who desired not exorbitance in the earth nor corruption. The issue ultimate is to the God-fearing. Marthid said, When I re-entered the room, I found that he had turned his face towards the Qibla and closed his eyes. He was dead. May Allah have mercy on him.